Marnetti. On November 8th, don't miss Shania Twink, your favorite all-queer femme country and pop cover band. On November 20th, Canadian rock and roll powerhouse JJ Wild comes back to town. And on November 25th, hip-hop icon Classified with support from Rhea May take the stage at the Broom. For additional information and to buy tickets, visit kppconcerts.com. See you at the shows.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, your campus community radio station, broadcasting to you since 1922.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We cannot take it anymore. We are being exterminated in Gaza. We are dying, and no one is standing beside us, nor is anyone able to solve our issue.
Israel's deadly campaign of starvation and forced expulsion in northern Gaza has entered its 20th day. We'll go to Tel Aviv to speak with B'Tselem, the prominent Israeli human rights group, which has described Israel's siege as ethnic cleansing. Then we look at Israel's intensifying war on journalists in Gaza. We'll talk to the head of the Committee to Protect Journalists as Israel prevents two critically injured journalists from leaving Gaza for life-saving medical care. Israel's also accusing six Al Jazeera reporters of having ties to Palestinian militants without providing any evidence. We'll also go to Lebanon as Israel continues to bombard southern Beirut and other areas.
Us, like everyone else, we left Tyre and what's in it. We took the children, grabbed what we could, and fled. Suddenly, while we were sitting by the sea, we heard that our house had been destroyed. We came back and looked, and our house had collapsed, as you can see.
Finally, we'll go to Michigan to speak with a prominent Muslim Democrat, a former congressional candidate, who was removed Monday from a Kamala Harris event that he was invited to attend.
I was sitting there, then they called me and they kicked me out of the rally. And they didn't provide any reason why they kicked me out of the rally. I guess I don't know why, because maybe I'm Muslim.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At least 17 Palestinians, including an 11-month-old baby, were killed today in Gaza's Nuseirat camp as Israel once again attacked a school-turned-shelter in central Deir al-Balah. In northern Gaza, Al Jazeera reports many civil defense rescue workers are refusing Israeli orders to evacuate, facing arrest and attacks as they continue their rescue missions, even as their capacity has been nearly wiped out by Israel's assault. Israel's siege on northern Gaza, now in its 20th day, has killed over 770 Palestinians. This is a displaced Palestinian woman who fled Beit Lahia.
I fled the intense bombardment in Beit Lahia. Martyrs and remains were all scattered on the ground. We do not know where to go. Truly, we don't know what state we have reached. We cannot take it anymore. We are being exterminated in Gaza. We are dying, and no one is standing beside us, nor is anyone able to solve our issue. We are innocent. We have nothing to do with everything that has happened. We are lost between a war and an extermination.
Al Jazeera has blasted Israel's dangerous escalation of its attack against the news network after the Israeli military claims six of its journalists are members of Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Al Jazeera responded, quote, "These fabricated accusations are a blatant attempt to silence the few remaining journalists in the region, thereby obscuring the harsh realities of the war from audiences worldwide," they said. We'll speak with the head of the Committee to Protect Journalists later in the broadcast. Israel's continuing its assault on Lebanon, carrying out 17 attacks on Beirut's southern suburbs overnight, leveling at least six buildings. One strike destroyed the offices of the Lebanese news station Al Mayadeen. Israel also killed three Lebanese soldiers in a separate strike. Meanwhile, health authorities are warning of a possible cholera outbreak among Lebanese children amidst mass displacement, attacks on the health system, and lack of clean water and food. The 400,000 displaced children in Lebanon are also at risk of other highly transmissible diseases like hepatitis A and measles. In France, President Emmanuel Macron pledged a 100 million euro aid package for Lebanon as he opened a conference in Paris to rally support for Lebanon and reiterate calls for a ceasefire. We'll go to Beirut for the latest after headlines. Here in the United States, Jewish students across the country say college administrators have cracked down on their Gaza solidarity sukkahs, which have been set up over the past week to mark the holiday of Sukkot. In some cases, schools have destroyed the sukkah huts. Jewish Voice for Peace said in a statement, quote, "These universities desecrate these students' Jewish practice because their faith is intertwined with their solidarity with the Palestinian people. A university has no right to dictate what types of Jewish practice are legitimate," they said. Here in New York City, faith leaders and other activists disrupted a city council meeting Wednesday to demand council members take up a vote on a Gaza ceasefire resolution. Protesters cried out, "City Council, you can't hide, no more bombs for genocide," as they held up their hands covered in red paint while being forcibly removed by security. Over 100 city councils across the United States have passed ceasefire resolutions. In Spain, over 300 academics, entertainers, artists, including the directors Pedro Almodóvar and Isabel Coixet, have signed on to a letter calling on Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez to enact a full arms embargo against Israel, writing, quote, "As long as Spain maintains military relations with Israel, it will continue to be complicit in this massacre," unquote. Sanchez has said Spain halted its weapons trade with Israel since October of last year, but investigations have revealed some military exports have still gone ahead. Turkey's military launched dozens of airstrikes across northern Iraq and Syria Wednesday in what the Turkish Defense Ministry said were attacks on positions held by the Kurdish PKK militia. The strikes came hours after officials in Ankara blamed the PKK for setting off explosives at the state-run aerospace company TUSAS, then opening fire, killing at least five people and injuring 22 others. No group has claimed responsibility. Aid agencies in eastern Chad are warning of deteriorating conditions in overcrowded camps for more than 500,000 Sudanese refugees who fled fighting between rival military factions since the outbreak of war in April 2023. The conflict has uprooted more than 11 million people across Sudan, with 26 million facing severe food insecurity. About 25,000 refugees from Sudan crossed into Chad in the first week of October alone. Those settling in refugee camps face poor living conditions, severe cuts to food rations, and few job prospects. Meanwhile, the UN says Sudan's warring factions continue to commit human rights violations, including possible war crimes and crimes against humanity. This is UN spokesperson Farhan Haq.
"We continue to receive reports of civilian casualties and indiscriminate attacks impacting public infrastructure and residential areas, both in North Darfur and elsewhere, with many areas effectively cut off from humanitarian assistance."
Kamala Harris's presidential campaign and allied groups raised $378 million in September, helping to break the record for the largest quarterly campaign fundraising haul in U.S. history. This, according to the new Federal Election Commission data. Major Harris donors include Facebook co-founder Dustin Moskovitz, Illinois billionaire Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker, and cryptocurrency billionaire Chris Larson. The New York Times reports billionaire Microsoft founder Bill Gates recently donated about $50 million $10 to a nonprofit backing Harris. Michael Bloomberg also has spent tens of millions on the Harris campaign. Donald Trump's campaign reports it raised $160 million in September. That includes over $14 million from a handful of oil and gas industry executives coming after Trump told fossil fuel companies he would roll back environmental protections in exchange for $1 billion in campaign contributions. On Wednesday, Trump rallied supporters in Duluth, Georgia, where he was introduced by the far-right TV personality Tucker Carlson, who compared Trump to an angry father whose children deserve to be spanked.
And when Dad gets home, you know what he says? You've been a bad girl. You've been a bad little girl, and you're getting a vigorous spanking right now.
Trump was later welcomed to the stage as the crowd chanted, "Daddy's home, Daddy's home." At the Georgia rally, Trump did not mention recent statements from his former chief of staff, retired Marine General John Kelly, who told the New York Times Trump made admiring comments about Adolf Hitler and would govern like a dictator if allowed. On Wednesday, Kamala Harris said she agrees with Kelly that Trump is a fascist.
Donald Trump is increasingly unhinged and unstable. And in a second term, people like John Kelly would not be there to be the guardrails against his propensities and his actions.
In other campaign news, the consumer advocacy watchdog Public Citizen filed a complaint with the Federal Election Commission on Wednesday over Elon Musk's $1 million daily giveaway to swing state voters. So far, at least four people, two in Pennsylvania and one in North Carolina, have received checks for $1 million. The Justice Department has reportedly sent a warning to Elon Musk's super PAC over the scheme. Meanwhile, the outlet The Lever reports Elon Musk could benefit from a massive tax benefit if Trump is reelected and appoints Musk to a government position. Trump has said he will create a new official role for Musk, Secretary of Cost Cutting. This comes as a new analysis from the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy finds Kamala Harris's tax proposals would overall increase taxes for the top 1% and lower them for everyone else, while Trump's policies would cut taxes for the wealthiest 5% and raise them for everyone else. Donald Trump is facing a new accusation of sexual misconduct. Stacey Williams worked as a model in 1993 when she says Donald Trump repeatedly groped her at Trump Tower. She was introduced to Trump by the now-deceased serial sexual predator and trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. Williams described the assault as a twisted game that had been orchestrated by Trump and Epstein. Trump's campaign denied the allegations. Boeing workers on the West Coast are extending their six-week-long strike after rejecting a proposed contract on Wednesday. Earlier in the day, Boeing reported a $6.1 billion loss. The deal, which was rejected by 64% of voters, included a 35% wage increase over 4 years. Striking workers are demanding a 40% raise and the reinstatement of their defined benefit pension plan. This is a Boeing machinist speaking ahead of the vote.
I think it's a decent contract, but I think it's not what we asked for. And I feel like the contract, it's not going to push the company forward for longevity in the long run. There's a lot of new hires that are struggling. I just feel like Boeing in this economy could do a lot better with all the money that we've made for them over the years.
A new study by Ohio State University finds the U.S. infant mortality rate spiked after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022, with hundreds more babies dying after states moved to restrict or ban abortion access. The largest increase came among infants with congenital anomalies or birth defects. Researchers believe that's because pregnant people living under abortion bans can no longer terminate pregnancies when fetal anomalies are detected in utero. And Gustavo Gutierrez, the Peruvian priest known as the father of liberation theology, has died at the age of 96. Liberation theology holds that ending poverty and helping those in need is an essential mission of the church. In his seminal 1971 book, A Theology of Liberation, Gutierrez wrote that poverty is, quote, an attack on human dignity and therefore contrary to the will of God, unquote. The school of thought was popularized in Latin America through the 60s and 70s, despite pushback pushback from the Vatican against liberation theology and its anchoring in Marxist principles. It continued to spread and played a role in political movements, including the Sandinista Revolution in Nicaragua. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. We begin today's show in Lebanon, where Israel continues to bombard the southern suburbs of Beirut. Health officials report Israel carried out at least 17 strikes overnight, leveling numerous buildings, including the offices of Al-Mayadeen, a Lebanese news station. Lebanon's national news agency described last night's attacks as the most violent in the area in recent weeks. Israel also killed 3 Lebanese soldiers in a strike in the southern part of the country. Israel continues to defy international calls for a ceasefire in Lebanon. This comes as French President Emmanuel Macron hosted an aid conference for Lebanon in Paris. Macron reiterated his call for a ceasefire and vowed to send over $100 million in humanitarian aid to Lebanon.
We go now to Beirut, Lebanon, where we're joined by Rima Majid. She's an assistant professor of sociology at the American University of Beirut. Thanks so much for being with us. If you can start off by talking about what's happening in one of the oldest cities in the world, in Tyre, in southern Lebanon.
Yes, thank you so much, Amy, for having me on the show again. What was happening yesterday was very, very disheartening, but it's really a crime of, of a global scale. Tyre is a very central city in terms of archaeology, of history, and this has been the second city. So Tyre is a city that is in the south and that is, inhabited by a large population. This is the second city in the south, large city in the south, that is being destructed in a systematic way. Yesterday, what we've reports say that the old ruins of Tyre have been hit by strikes. We have seen similar reports from other archaeological and historical sites, such as Baalbek, before. These are ruins that have survived thousands of years and that are being now destroyed by Israel. Unfortunately, we're not seeing the same alarm that we saw when other ruins, whether in Syria or Iraq, were targeted. And I think this is a very important issue to flag and to talk about.
So Rima Majid, can you say why you think these attacks on these ruins have not received the kind of attention they should? Has UNESCO, for example, at least made a comment?
Yeah, I think the whole war on Lebanon is not receiving the attention that it needs to receive. I mean, there is a full-blown war that is taking very little space in the global media for several reasons. One of them is, unfortunately, wars in this part of the world has become material for consumption, and there's maybe a media fatigue, but also there's an impunity that Israel has been enjoying since a long time, but that has become very flagrant since last year, where at this point what we cover is, survival and bare life. There's so much to cover in terms of people, forced expulsions, people dying, that talking about ruins and history and archaeology is maybe seen not as a priority, but it's a devastating conflict or it's a devastating war that is destroying all sorts of life and on this land, whether social life or even when we think about history.
Rima Majid, if you could respond to what we said earlier, which is that France has pledged €100 million in support, humanitarian aid support to Lebanon, and in particular also comment on what the defense minister, the French defense minister, Sébastien Lecornu, said earlier this week on Monday, that quote, and this is a quote from him, our position, that is to say France's position, right now is primarily driven by the fear of an imminent civil war in Lebanon.
Sure. So on the question of humanitarian aid, I mean, France has just pledged today in the same conference in Paris. The UAE has also pledged, and I'm sure other countries will pledge money. Unfortunately, I mean, this is the hypocrisy of this global system. What we're getting, I mean, we've gotten to this point where humanitarianism has become really dehumanizing. The same countries that are sending, I mean, many of those countries that are sending us humanitarian aid are at the same time selling arms and sending arms to Israel to kill us. And the profit they make out of the arms industry is way bigger than what we get in terms of humanitarian aid. So in that sense, it's become really dehumanizing that we're turned into objects of humanitarian support that targets, again, just their life. I mean, the aim now is for people to survive, to have shelter, even if it's not decent shelter, and, you know, just the basics of survival. We don't talk about social lives that have been disrupted, about, dreams that are gone, about plans that are now up in the air, about families that have been, that have lost loved ones or been displaced. So I think this is way bigger than anything humanitarian aid can solve. We saw last week when President Macron tried to insinuate that France should consider an arms embargo on Israel. I mean, we saw the backlash from Netanyahu and others. So I think at this point, to me, this is really hypocritical. On the second point of the comment on a possible civil war in Lebanon, there's a lot of talk inside the country and outside, of course, about the possibility of sliding into a war, social tensions that are increasing because of the effects of displacement and tension in different neighborhoods. Lebanon is already a sectarianized country where, these boundaries can shift quickly and can, become very tense. But the point we don't talk about is that civil wars are not the result of social tension. I mean, we never slip into a civil war. Wars, whether civil or not, are political decisions. And therefore, the question today is, who is going to fund? I mean, yes, I'm not saying a war is impossible. Actually, it is very possible, a civil war. But the question is, who's going to fund it? Who's going to back it politically at the regional level and at the international level? Who's going to send arms? These are the questions that we need to answer, rather than thinking that there's that wars are social explosions. They're not. Revolutions are social explosions.
Earlier this week, at least 13 people, including a child, were killed and about 60 others injured in Israeli airstrike near the Rafik Hariri University Hospital, Lebanon's largest public medical center. At least 32 others were wounded in the attack, which caused major damage to the hospital. Separately, 50 medical workers and 15 patients were forced to evacuate from the Al-Sahel Hospital in southern Beirut Monday after Israel's military claimed without evidence its home to a secret underground Hezbollah bunker containing hundreds of millions of dollars in cash and gold. Doctors insisted there's nothing hidden beneath the hospital and took reporters on a tour of its lower floors to disprove the claims. This is Alex Rossi, international correspondent for Sky News.
This is the Al-Sahel Hospital on the outskirts of Dahir. Dahir, of course, is a stronghold of Hezbollah. Now, we're in the basement. This is, it's alleged by the Israelis that this hospital is being used by Hezbollah as a way of storing gold and cash. Now, we've been invited in here. This tour has been in no way exhaustive. You can see there are lots of other press here as well. But we haven't been controlled in terms of what we can film or where we can point our camera. We've been allowed to open doors, move around. Now, there may be other areas of the hospital that we've not been taken to, but for all, this looks like a hospital.
That's Alex Rossi, again, international correspondent for Sky News. If you could respond, Rima Majed, to what happened there, and also talk about the U.S. State Department once again shoring up Israel and what it's doing. The spokesperson, Matt Miller, saying we've seen footage that's emerged over the course of the past 2 weeks of rockets and other military weapons held in civilian homes. So Israel does have a right to go after those legitimate targets.
Yes, I mean, the targeting of the Hariri hospital was also very personal to me because this is exactly where I grew up, actually. This is the neighborhood where I lived for several years. And it targeted civilians, mainly. All the other attacks are also targeting civilians. And this logic of, whether the German foreign minister's logic of Israel having the right to target civilians, and now there's a new logic of the right to target gold and money as a terrorist threat, is completely absurd. We've never seen. Would this apply to Israel? Does Lebanon have the right to defend itself the way, using the same techniques and tactics that Israel uses? Of course not. This goes against every logic of protection of human rights, but also just protection of this protection of civilians is basic here. So I think what we're seeing is a complete degeneration into a war that has no rules, that respects no international conventions, and there's one side in this war that has complete impunity. We've seen this over the past year, and it's continuing. Israel is targeting civilians in most cases. What is the logic of targeting gold and money? If let's assume this is really what there is there. Why target it with a bomb? What is the logic of this? This is just terrorism, this is what it should be called.
And Rima Majid, if you could talk about the attacks, in fact, on financial associations, the branches of a financial association reportedly linked to Hezbollah earlier this week, in fact, on Sunday. What is the Al-Qarz Al-Hassan Association, and why was it hit?
It's one of the financial institutions that are believed to be controlled by Hezbollah. It follows the same logic of, the neoliberal turn of, giving microfinance. So this is not an aid institution. This is a bank that gives microfinance facilities. What we have been seeing is that Israel is moving from the decapitation, which is continuing, of leaders, but there's also very clear targeting of Hezbollah's social institutions, whether hospitals, schools, banks, etc. So the aim is probably to dismantle, the target is not just Hezbollah as an organization, but it's also, its constituency, its people. And when I say it's people or its constituencies, it doesn't mean that these are Hezbollah fighters or members. These are just Lebanese civilians who have a political opinion that happens to be in support of that party. If we apply the logic on any other party, it would sound horrendous. The fact that we are justifying, hearing the German foreign minister, who then, after saying what she said about justifying the right of Israel to kill civilians, then visiting Beirut, is really, the world today feels like the turn of the 20th century, the dark years of fascism. It's very alarming that this is how we're dealing with these wars, and this is the logic with which we're justifying the killing of some, but of course not others.
Majid, finally, we just have a minute left. If you could talk about Security Council Resolution 1701, Amos Hochstein, who was just in the region, has said its implementation is the only way to end the war between Israel and Hezbollah.
Yeah, Hochstein is, it's interesting that the negotiator is, served in the Israeli offense, the IOF, I would call it. Has a clear side in this war. Personally, I think this is a resolution that ended the 2006 war. At this point, I don't think any of the parties, whether it's Israel or Hezbollah, at this point, it doesn't matter what Hezbollah says. Even if Hezbollah today says that they, you know, they want to stop this war, and they agree on everything, including 1701, which they have agreed on several times. I mean, just days before Nasrallah was killed, he had, you know, agreed on the implementation of 1701. I think at this point there's a plan that Israel will move on to implement, and that goes beyond what we're hearing from these diplomats. That is a plan that is in line with the Abraham Accords, with changing the face of the Middle East, and unfortunately, it's people like us who are paying the price.
Rima Majed, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Assistant Professor of Sociology at the American University of Beirut, speaking to us from Beirut, Lebanon. Coming up, Israel's deadly campaign of starvation and forced expulsion in northern Gaza has entered its 20th day. We'll go to Tel Aviv to speak with B'Tselem, the prominent Israeli human rights group which described Israel's siege as ethnic cleansing. Stay with us. Sick of Myself by Matthew Sweet, who recently had a debilitating stroke on tour, and fans are now raising funds for his recovery. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Health workers in northern Gaza have been forced to postpone the latest phase of the polio vaccination program as Israel continues to carry out a deadly campaign of forced expulsion and starvation in northern Gaza. Earlier today, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned Israel's actions, saying, quote, "People suffering under the ongoing Israeli siege in North Gaza are rapidly exhausting all available means for their survival." Doctors in northern Gaza have described horrific conditions as hospitals are overwhelmed and remaining medical staff are unable to treat the injured. Dr. Hussam Abu Safia is the director of Kamal Adwan Hospital.
We're talking on the 18th day of an imposed complete siege on the medical establishment and the North Gaza Strip. We appealed yesterday, the day before yesterday, and today we call on the world. The Kamal Adwan medical supply storage is at zero. We have no blood bags that we can offer to the wounded, no medical supplies or urgently needed medicine. Some members of our medical staff are either martyred, killed, or injured. A little while ago, we received one of our colleagues who was martyred, Dr. Mohammed Ghanem. He was offering humanitarian services at one of the medical checkpoints in a shelter. The situation is catastrophic. We will be facing a humanitarian catastrophe if there is no solution to this situation in the next few coming hours. The hospital will turn into a mass grave. There is a huge number of wounded people, and approximately every hour we lose one of them as a martyr. The wounded turn into martyrs due to the absence of needed medical supplies, tools, and medical staff were either detained, wounded, or martyred. Our medical staff and ambulances cannot get the wounded out of the street of Beit Lahia. We are talking about the wounded who managed to come to the hospital. They arrive and we give them our services. Those who cannot come to us stay in the streets and are martyred. This is what is happening in the north of Gaza.
That was Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, director of the Kamal Adwan Hospital in Beit Lahia in northern Gaza. And this is Lina Issam Abu Nada, a Palestinian who recently fled Beit Lahia.
I fled the intense bombardment in Beit Lahia. Martyrs and remains were all scattered on the ground. We do not know where to go. Truly, we don't know what state we have reached. I swear by God, what we are going through is the hardest situation in days. Even the occupation, Israel, took my brother as they put all the men on one side and let us leave. The tank moved and covered us with dust. On top of everything, no one is standing for us. We ask you, with all the mercy you have, to stand beside us. What's happening to us is unfair. We cannot take it anymore. We are being exterminated in Gaza. We are dying, and no one is standing beside us, nor is anyone able to solve our issue. We are innocent. We have nothing to do with everything that has happened. We are lost between a war and an extermination. We can't take it anymore.
A Palestinian woman who recently fled Beit Lahia. Earlier this week, the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem accused Israel of committing ethnic cleansing in northern Gaza. We go now to Tel Aviv, Israel, where we're joined by B'Tselem's international advocacy lead, Sarit Mikhaeli. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Sarit. Explain what you mean by ethnic cleansing and what exactly you understand is happening in northern Gaza, and how much Israelis understand what is happening right nearby.
So thank you, Amy, very much for the opportunity to be with you today. I think B'Tselem decided to make this statement as really an act of desperation. It's impossible for us to continue to watch, to observe the very little information we are getting from northern Gaza, the very fragmented information, and not conclude that what is going on there is the deliberate pressuring by the Israeli army of the civilian population of the area to move out of this area in order to empty it of Palestinians. This is ethnic cleansing, the definition that we would argue is the Israeli current actions on the ground. And I think it's important to remember that this is happening within a context. The context is not only increasing and ongoing reports that this is the Israeli policy, that this notion of the so-called island plan or the general's plan that called on Israel to essentially starve the population of northern Gaza in order to get it to move out of the way, right? So that's one element of the picture. And then the second element is that there is a growing debate, there is a growing level of activism within the Israeli far right to demand the settling of northern Gaza. Now, this is the context to what we are seeing on the ground at the moment. I think it's important also to mention that the Israeli army itself has admitted in a response to a high court petition submitted by several Israeli human rights organizations that for the first 2 weeks of this month, no humanitarian aid was allowed in to North Gaza. That was deliberate. That was knowingly. That isn't something that the Israeli authorities deny. That, and in addition, in the response submitted yesterday to the High Court, Israel also states that this is continuing when it comes to Jabalia. And we know that yesterday the Israeli army issued some drone footage showing throngs of civilians walking out from the Jabalia refugee camp towards the south, and also saying that Israel managed to break the so-called Hamas siege on Jabalia, and said that about 20,000 civilians have already left. From our perspective, all this indicates one clear goal, which is to remove the people from northern Gaza, to empty that area. I also think, and we can maybe discuss it a bit in more length later on, there are also quite open admissions within the Israeli media that some of this is happening. Certainly not in the framing of an international crime, but commentators have accepted on some levels that this is what Israel is doing now in North Gaza.
Well, let me just read, Sarit Mikhaili, what the media has said. This is on Israel's Channel 12. The chief political analyst saying, quote, "We can keep denying that what's happening is an implementation of the general's plan, emptying of the strip, starving the terrorists, eliminating them, capturing them. That's, in my opinion, what's happening here." So, you know, in effect, would you say that the general's plan itself constitutes ethnic cleansing? And then to what extent do people in Israel believe that that's what's occurring? If it's being said in the media, is there some consensus around it? Although I will note that what he said was starving the terrorists, eliminating them, not the general population there.
Well, first of all, I want to be clear that Israel, we suspect, and as we also announced together with colleagues in other human rights organizations last week, we suspect that Israel is implementing the spirit, I would say, maybe not necessarily every single aspect of this so-called general's plan, but that is quietly implementing this. And this is why we also called last week on the international community to really take responsibility for what is going on in Gaza. And we stated openly that it's not just Israeli policymakers who should be held accountable and face consequences for these crimes, but also that the international community cannot be considered complicit if Israel goes ahead and empties North Gaza of its inhabitants. I think that when we look at this plan, this absolutely horrific plan, it includes provisions that are absolutely and clearly war crimes and could probably also be viewed as crimes against humanity. The idea is actually to basically starve the population out in order to leave the area. And then, according to this plan, and certainly I don't agree with any aspect of the logic, the only people remaining will be terrorists, and then they can just be killed off. This is the, again, I don't want to simplify too much, but this is the essential logic of this plan. But it is absolutely in contradiction with many of the known facts we know about the situation in Gaza and in North Gaza. The fact that many of the civilians there cannot leave or don't want to leave. Some of them cannot leave because it's impossible for them to move around, because they just have no other place to go, or they don't want to leave these areas because they know that the same sort of fate of being bombarded and exposed to Israeli attacks can, wait for them in the many internally displaced camps throughout Gaza, where people are not safe in any way. So there are many reasons why Palestinians would not want to leave North Gaza. So that's the first issue. The second issue, and certainly the idea that you can somehow force them out permanently, right, without not for their own security, is absolutely illegal. The second issue that is very clearly part of the illegality and the shocking lack of morals, I would say, also moral failure of this plan, is that the idea that you can somehow decide that after a certain moment where you say you told all civilians to leave a certain area, that means that everyone left in there is a combatant, a terrorist, and you can just kill them, that is also not true. That's simply not the way international humanitarian law goes. Civilians don't lose their protective status if you gave them an illegal and probably also impossible to implement evacuation order. The idea that somehow a person should be considered a legitimate military target, regardless of what they're actually doing, because they happen to be in a certain place that the Israeli army decided is no longer acceptable, that is not legal. That is clearly a war crime. And I have to also say that this isn't just you know, things we are saying here at B'Tselem. In recent days, there have been several much more mainstream Israelis, including the former deputy leader of the Israeli National Security Council, who also said that these kinds of orders would be, you know, orders that a black flag is flying over. These would be orders to commit war crimes, and that soldiers have to refuse to obey these kinds of orders. This is, as I said, this is a former Israeli security official. I think it's really important to remember also, though, that the current situation on the ground, unfortunately, isn't, and again, I say it with a great deal of pain, isn't really influenced by statements by human rights organizations like B'Tselem, by actions by Israeli, wonderful and just very courageous Israeli human rights organizations that are now petitioning the High Court, because we just simply don't have the capacity to influence the reality on the ground at the moment.
Therefore,
that is why that is the essential source of our call.
So, Sarit Mekhaeli, we just
call
have
to
a
the
minute.
International community.
We just have a minute. I want to go to that issue of the call of the international community, and particularly the U.S. Blinken has just left Israel, his 11th trip there, saying he's pushing for a ceasefire. Yet at the same time, the Biden administration continuing to arm Netanyahu. In this last 30 seconds, your thoughts on that kind of approach, saying he should push for a ceasefire, but we'll continue to arm you.
It's absolutely clear that we must have a ceasefire. We need a ceasefire and we need the hostage deal now. But this isn't going to happen unless Prime Minister Netanyahu is placed in a situation where he has to accept this. And we do not see this happening at the moment. I think the thought that somehow the U.S. administration can ask Netanyahu, can urge Netanyahu for a ceasefire, and this will actually happen, is simply unrealistic. There needs to be intense pressure to get Israel to currently accept a ceasefire, to stop what it's doing in northern Gaza. And it has to come from action by the United States and the international community. Otherwise, they will also be complicit in what we're seeing now.
Sarit Mekhaeli, I want to thank you for being with us, international advocacy lead for the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, which has accused the Israeli military of committing ethnic cleansing in northern Gaza. Next up, we look at Israel's intensifying war on journalists in Gaza, two critically wounded journalists not able to get out of Gaza, and Israel saying that six journalists are members of Hamas or Palestinian Jihad. What that means? We'll speak with the head of Committee to Protect Journalists. Stay with us.
I will wake in the morning if you call, and I'll stand beside you long as I can.
Crumble With You If You Fall, covered by Bernice Johnson Regan, produced by Barbara Dane and released on the Paradigm Records label she co-founded. Barbara Dane died this week at the age of 97. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to Israel's intensifying war on journalists. On Wednesday, the Israeli military publicly accused six Al Jazeera journalists of being members of Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Press freedom groups blasted the Israeli military for releasing what some have described as a kill list for the journalists. In a statement, Al Jazeera said, quote, Al Jazeera categorically rejects the Israeli occupation forces' portrayal of our journalists as terrorists and denounces their use of fabricated evidence. The network views these fabricated accusations as a blatant attempt to silence the few remaining journalists in the region, thereby obscuring the harsh realities of the war from audiences worldwide. This comes as Israel continues to block the evacuation of of two Al Jazeera camera operators who were severely injured after being shot by Israeli troops. One of the journalists, Fadi Al-Wahidi, has been in a coma after being shot in the neck.
We're joined now by Jody Ginsberg, Chief Executive Officer of the Committee to Protect Journalists here in New York. Jody, let's start with the two journalists who are gravely wounded. One of them is paralyzed and in a coma. Israel's not letting them be evacuated. Can you talk about the significance of this?
Well, yes. Fadi has been in a coma for over a week now, and not just in a coma, but with no access to painkillers. We've heard, obviously, about the ongoing bombardment in Gaza and what that has meant for hospitals. Al Jazeera has asked repeatedly, used all the formal channels to request their evacuation, and so far has had no reply. And this follows a pattern in which journalists appear to be being punished for doing their work, for exposing what's happening inside Gaza.
And Jody Ginsberg, if you could, let's go to these six Al Jazeera journalists who've been accused by Israel of being terrorists. You have pointed to, the CPJ has pointed to contradictory information that's been released by the IDF in the past, at least one recent instance. Ismail Al-Ghul, explain who he was and what the IDF said about him.
So Ismail Al-Ghul was an Al Jazeera correspondent. He was killed along with a freelance camera operator, Rami Al-Rafi, near Gaza City in July. And the IDF alleged that Al-Ghul was an engineer in a Hamas brigade, and that justified his killing. They published a document which they said was a record of Hamas military activity as proof of these accusations. Some of the information indicated that Al-Ghul, who was born in 1997, had received a Hamas military ranking in 2007, so he would have been 10 years old. So the document was not, in our view, credible. And unfortunately, this is not a one-off incident. There is a pattern of Israel making these kinds of allegations, providing evidence that is frankly not credible, or in some cases, no evidence at all.
Jody, especially, you know, talk about the significance of Israel doing this now. No one else, no other reporter is in Gaza. It's only Al Jazeera reporters who are. Over 4,000 journalists have traveled to Israel to cover this war since October last year, but no other journalists have been permitted in.
It's hugely significant. This is the deadliest conflict for journalists that CPJ has ever documented. 128 journalists at least have been killed, 126 of them by Israel, and most of those are Palestinians. And in many cases, we believe those journalists who have been deliberately targeted for being journalists. Now, you're right that the major issue in all of this is that those journalists who remain are the only people who are able to provide us information about what's happening inside Gaza. No journalist from outside Gaza has been allowed in since the start of that war, and that's highly unusual. I speak to lots of war correspondents who've covered many, many wars over decades, and all of them talk about how unprecedented this is, you know, to not have any access whatsoever. And that, of course, puts additional pressure on these journalists. And what you have when you have these kinds of accusations from Israel that the journalists are terrorists is a kind of justification for then killing them.
So you have Democratic Congress member James McGovern leading 64 other Congress members in a letter to Biden and Blinken, urging them to push for Israel to allow in international journalists. At the same time, Jody Ginsberg, if you can talk about the number of journalists who've been killed in Gaza. Isn't this unprecedented?
It's totally unprecedented. This number is more journalists were killed in the first 10 weeks of the war, just the first 10 weeks of the war, than have ever been killed in a single country over an entire year. That gives you some sense of the scale of this. Those journalists who remain are trying desperately to cover the impact of the war while suffering the same effects of the war as everyone else, the deprivations of food, the lack of shelter, the continual displacement, the lack of equipment. And as we have fewer and fewer journalists reporting and the challenge becomes greater and greater, of course, we have less and less information coming out of Gaza. And it's absolutely essential that we have that information, that we have those images, so that the international community can understand the scale of what's happening.
Jody Ginsberg, finally, if you could put this in a broader context, is there any other precedent for Europe, the U.S., or any of its allies restricting access to all international journalists to a war zone for over a year, as has happened here?
There's no precedent like this. In wars, inevitably, one side or other will restrict access to journalists. That we see that frequently. But it is unheard of that not a single international journalist has been able to get into Gaza for an entire year. And remember that it's not just about the access. Of course, that's a major issue. But we have Gazan journalists doing phenomenal work in Gaza and in the West Bank. It's not just about the access. It's also about the attacks that we've seen on media facilities, which is civilian infrastructure. We've seen repeated communications blackouts. We've seen the banning of Al Jazeera and the closure of the Al Jazeera Ramallah Bureau. So it's not simply, we've seen arrests of journalists, both in Gaza and the West Bank. So it's not simply the dangers, the killing of journalists, egregious as that is. It's the whole pattern and systematic attempts, and quite successful attempts, to censor what is happening inside Gaza.
Jody Ginsberg, I want to thank you for being with us, CEO of the Committee to Protect Journalists. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We end today's show with a Muslim American Democrat who was ejected from a Kamala Harris rally in Metro Detroit, where Harris was joined by Republican former Congressmember Liz Cheney. Ahmad Ghanem is a Democratic Party activist and former House candidate for Michigan's 11th District.
He joins us now from Oak Park, Michigan, not far from the Harris campaign event, which he was ejected from. The Kamala Harris campaign has since said it regrets his removal. Thank you so much for being with us, Ahmad Ghanem. In this few minutes that we have left, take us to the event that you were invited to and explain what happened.
Thank you for having me. So basically, I went like anyone else. I was dressed in a suit going to this event, stood in line. It was a small event by invite, only 200 people at, there, less than 200 people. I went through securities like the airport security where they have to check everything. They take even the signs that you have from the campaign. So nobody had any signs. You only have your wallet and that's it. And I was cleared by security. I was seated like anyone. I was sitting there for like 10 or 15 minutes just trying to answer some emails. I did not engage with anybody in conversation because they seat you randomly with people you don't know around you. And after 10 minutes, a lady came and told me, can you follow me? And I thought probably they are changing my seat. I said, that's fine. I followed her. And at the door, I found two police officers waiting for me and said, they don't want you here at the event. If you either leave now or I put you in a police car. And that was shocking to me. I was sitting there and I did not do anything. I did nothing. And now I'm threatened to be arrested or have to leave. And I was just asking, I told him, okay, I'm going to leave. I just want to know, why are you kicking me out? And he said, it is not me. It's the venue that's kicking you out. So I asked him, why would the venue kick me out? The venue, they don't know anything about me. It's just the venue. He said, I didn't know. And the lady that escorted me out, she ended the conversation. I said, this is not a conversation anymore. You have to be escorted out. So I didn't want to escalate the situation, and I just left.
And Ahmad, can you say whether since you've left, have you heard anything further about why you were removed?
No. The campaign issued a brief statement saying they regret what happened. They gave me a call. I thanked them for the call, but I said, I want to know, why was I removed? Because apology without accountability is not an apology. So far, they did not provide any information on, or any reason why they removed me.
So, Anna Gunnim, you were a congressional candidate. You didn't win the primary. You got 15,000 votes. After you were kicked out of the Kamala Harris event, the Trump campaign approached you to make an ad?
That's correct. They approached me to make an ad against Haley, against Vice President Harris. And they said this ad will be aired everywhere, and CNN everywhere, but we want you to film it. And I said, no, I cannot do that.
Why do you feel that? I mean, of course, President Trump, well known when his first acts in office as president was the Muslim ban. But if you can explain what you're demanding now of the Kamala Harris campaign.
I'm demanding a reason why they ejected me from the campaign without anything. I didn't have any Palestinian kufiya. I didn't have any pens. I didn't have any signs. I was not planning to protest. I just was sitting there. This is my city where I ran. Everyone in this city, they know me because I ran there. I was canvassing door to door there. My ads were there. My signs were there. I actually spoke at the Democratic Club in Royal Oak, Michigan. So it's not like I'm a random person. They know me very well. And there is a reason why they ejected me. So I want to know what is the reason. And for me, when people talk about just one issue voter, it's not about Gaza. Gaza's far away from me. It's a very important issue for me. But now it's important, what's more important, do I have place in this party or not? Is this the party of diversity and inclusion, or Muslims and Arabs don't have room anymore in this party?
Well, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Ahmed Ghanim, Muslim community leader, former Democratic congressional candidate, speaking to us from Oak Park, Michigan, on Monday, given no explanation when he was kicked out of an invitation-only Harris campaign event in Royal Oak, Michigan, to which he was invited. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for our video news production and digital fellowships. To learn more, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
Our waiter.
Yes, I'd like a bowl of hot alphabet soup.
Hi, my name is Hayden, and I have a new show on CFRC called Alphabet Soup.
A bowl of...